welcome to another Saturday on Woods and Water, South Carolina. Hope the weather's good where you are. And if it's good, that means you need to be outside. Wish I was. But someday soon, I will be. In fact, I got a couple of great trips coming up. Going to have some good pictures to put up on the Facebook website. So stay tuned. And like I said, I hope you're getting out there and enjoying this great spring weather we're having right here in South Carolina. Got Ben Lancaster in the studio with us today.
Hey,
Ben,
buddy.
How are you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. Glad you made the drive up from Columbia.
It wasn't too bad.
I
got to sleep in about 30 extra minutes. It worked out pretty good.
That's because he lives in Irmo, so instead of having to go from Irmo into Columbia, he just sleeps a little late and comes to Greenville.
I might do this every once a week.
Hey, come on. There's room in the studio. We'd love to have you. But anyway, we're gonna talk. Ben and I were both at the Quality Deer Management Association convention in Louisville, Kentucky this past week. We'll talk a little bit about that, and then Ben, who is a major league turkey hunter,
whatever,
actually got to go to where? Montana?
Broadus, Montana,
and
the Powder River.
And you got a two.
We had 17.
17 altogether.
I got my two legal Miriams. Yep.
Impressive. So he's going to tell us about that, because, you know, as much as South Carolina has to offer in the outdoors, every once in a while, boy, it's nice to just take off and road trip it.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben's here to do our first road trip for us. We appreciate that.
Good deal.
Let's see. Not going to do a calendar of events this week because we've got so much to pack into this show. But I will put up a few things that are going to be happening. So check the Facebook page. And like, as always, you can listen to this show right there on 94.5 on your FM dial. You can go to the conservativetalk945.com website. Click the Listen Live link on the right-hand side of the page. That'll stream it straight to wherever you are. Or you can get the free Conservative Talk app for your phone or tablet. And then you can keep up with this show on Facebook at facebook.com/woodsandwatersc, hashtag woodsandwatersc radio on Instagram. And the website is woodsandwatersc.com, what's a lot to remember. This coming week. Very important week. You know, there's certain weeks set apart during the year that focus on this, that, the other. This next week, May the 16th through the 22nd, is National Safe Boating Week. And I know a lot of people are already showing me pictures of fish they've caught and evenings on the lake with the sunsets and all. And it's important to remember that, you know, we need to be safe while we're out there. And it kicks off with a reminder for boaters to always wear it. Wearing a life jacket is the simplest life-saving strategy for safe boating. This is a release out of Manassas, Virginia, which is the national headquarters for the National Boating Safety Week. Boating safety advocates across the U.S. and Canada have teamed up to promote safe and responsible boating, including consistent life jacket wear every time boaters are on the water during National Safe Boating Week held May 16th through the 22nd. Now, you can wear it. The other important thing to do is to use the kill switch on your boat motor. You know, a lot of people, that's one of those things you just don't. You know, you plug it in, yeah. It's a pain, but you'd be amazed. The one time you don't use it is when you wish you'd used it. So anyway, that's just kind of a little rabbit trail from this. But Boating Safety Week is the launch of the 2015 North America Safe Boating Campaign. The year-long campaign promotes safe and responsible boating and the value of voluntary, consistent life jacket wear by recreational boaters throughout the national theme. Wear it. What looks like a perfect day for boating can quickly become hazardous if you end up in the water, said Rachel Johnson, executive director of the National Safe Boating Council. You can have a great time while choosing to wear a life jacket, always wear a life jacket, and being a responsible boater. And I was just, this media release comes with all sorts of statistics and all, but the U.S. Coast Guard statistics show that drowning was the reported cause of death in 3/4 of recreational boating fatalities in 2013, and that 84% of those who drowned were not wearing life jackets. And it goes on to a separate page, recreational boating safety facts. Drowning was reported, as I said, in 3/4 of all fatalities. Approximately 84% of those who drowned were not wearing life jackets. In 2013, the Coast Guard counted 4,062 accidents that involved 560 deaths, 2,620 injuries, and approximately $39 million of damage to property as a result of recreational boating accidents. We had about 2 weeks ago, we had a death in Charleston. A gentleman ran into Chute's Folly, had 3 people in the boat. He died. The other 2 ladies ended up in the hospital. So it happens. And it, Yes, accidents are going to happen no matter how safe you are, but there are certain steps that all of us need to take. It goes on, the fatality rate was 4.7 deaths per 100,000 registered recreational voters vessels. It's a 13% decrease from 2012, fatality rate of 5.4 deaths per 100,000. 13% of deaths occurred on boats where the operator had received boating safety instruction. So it just proves, no matter how prepared you are, there's a certain amount of this stuff is just going to happen to you. Operator inattention, improper lookout, operator inexperience, excessive speed, and machinery failure rank as the top five primary contributing factors in accidents. Alcohol use ranks as a contributing factor in 16% of the deaths. And here's one that gets you, and we're all about children. A couple weekends ago, my daughter took place in the Guard Your Life Challenge out at BMW, and we're talking about distracted driving and getting prepared. Well, 22 children under age 13 lost their lives while boating in 2013. 8 of them who died in 2013 died from drowning. The most common types of vessels involved in reported accidents were motorboats, 46, PWCs, 18%, and the rest, miscellaneous cabin motor cruisers is what they call them. Top ranking states for boating deaths, Florida, of course, you'd expect that, but South Carolina comes in there at number 4 with 27. We don't make the top 10 in states for reporting boating accidents. That's a good thing. Ready, set, wear it. Life Jacket World Record Day. They're looking for everybody to wear their life jackets today, May the 16th. So if you're on the water this afternoon and the weather's nice, wear those life jackets. Life jacket facts, style, variety, and comfort. We all know there's a lot of life jackets out there. For cruising and open, comfort's key. Choose a life jacket you'll want to wear for ages 16 and older. Inflatable life jackets are a great option, and those are. For fishing, you know, the vest style life jackets come with pockets and clips, but if you watch a lot of the professional anglers, they're wearing the inflatable vest just like everybody else does. PWCs, you want to make sure those things are rugged. Multiple buckles and clasps just keep them secure after impact with the water, because there's nothing between you and the water on a PWC. And it goes into cold weather hunting. For paddling, special life jackets are designed with large openings for arms to allow ease of movement. For children, virtually all styles available are sized, especially for children, some with cartoon characters. We've all had those. Big Bird, I think I had one. And, of course, my kids are a lot older now, so you know, mine are dated. And the last, one of the last things that has is how to choose the right life jacket. We've talked just there about life jacket facts. The first one is try it on. When you're in the store buying it, check the manufacturer's ratings for your size and weight. That's important. Make sure the life jacket's properly zipped or buckled while you have it on. Raise your arms straight up over your head while wearing your life jacket just to make sure it doesn't ride up on you. If there's excessive room above the openings, the life jacket rides up over your chin and face, it does not fit properly. Fit facts, it's extremely important that you choose a properly fitting life jacket. Life jackets that are too big will cause the flotation device to push up around your face, which is could be dangerous, and life jackets that are too small may not be able to keep your body afloat. Important reminders, make sure that your life jacket is U.S. Coast Guard approved. Double check that your life jacket is appropriate for your favorite water activities. Take the time to make sure it fits properly. Check your life jackets every year to make sure they're in good condition, no tears or holes. Test them to make sure they work properly and that you don't need to get the larger size up. Life jackets meant for adult-sized people do not work for children. If you are boating with children, make sure they are wearing the properly fitted child-sized life jackets based on their weight. Do not buy a life jacket for your child to grow into. And trust me, if Department of Natural Resources pulls you over in a boating check and you have an adult-sized life jacket on a kid, you're probably going to get a ticket. They don't like to see those kids in those adult-sized jackets because they ride right up and right over their heads and do them no good at all. So, hey, you hate to scare people, but National Boating Safety Week next week. Make a point. Check your equipment. So when you're out on the lake, you can have a good time. There's the breeze. We'll be back on the other side of the break. We're going to talk a little quality deer management. Woo! Yeah. All right. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. First segment, we did a little boating safety for those of you going to be out on the water this summer. It's a good thing to remind ourselves. I know I did hiking safety last week, boating safety this week. Trust me, I won't hit you another safety thing until deer season comes in the fall and we get ready for some gun safety. And then I might get somebody who's a little better versed in it to come in and talk about it. I had to put this one together in a short amount of time because I just found out about this next week. So anyway, we're going to shift gears here a little bit, talk a little, maybe not deer hunting, but talk about deer. Future of deer, some of the things that are out there, issues and all. I pulled Ben Lancaster in here. Like I said, we were both at the Quality Deer Management Association convention in Louisville, Kentucky. He came in on Friday. I was there Wednesday, Thursday for the National Deer Alliance. Right off the bat, though, Ben's company, which is Outdoor Underwriters in Columbia, is a very unique business. Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about it before we get into the nitty-gritty and nuts and bolts of what we went to last year. Tell us a little bit about Outdoor Underwriters and what they actually do through Quality Deer Management Association.
Well, we're very fortunate that Brian Murphy and the team at QDMA saw fit to partner with us years ago. And by, when partner, I mean that we help underwrite the hunt lease liability program for QDMA. And so if you lease property from a landowner anywhere in the country, the QDMA hunt lease liability program is what we underwrite. The benefit of the program is you get really competitive hunt lease rates, but the landowner and the club member also become QDMA members. And you get the Quality Whitetails magazine, you get all the in on what's going on with QDMA and the future of deer hunting. And so it's more than just a hunt lease program. You actually are supporting conservation, and we're just very fortunate that they saw fit to partner with us to do that. So it's been really good. It's going on a long time, too, 15 plus years, I believe.
Wow. You like relationships that last that long.
Yeah, man.
Think we'll make it 15 years?
I don't know, man. I don't know. You got to start acting right. You got to start behaving.
I try to, but you know, when I walked up to him at the convention, he like turned and faced the other way, like he didn't see me. And I'm like, well, that's not very nice. Well,
just messing around.
We have a good time. Ben and I, you know, there's some people out there, when you meet them, you just know this is my kind of person.
There you go.
So anyway. Okay. Quality Deer Management Association. Some of you out there are members. Some of you out there have never heard about it. Some of you out there aren't deer hunters. Yep. But QDMA actually started, had its roots right here in Greenville back in 1988 with Joe Hamilton, who's pretty much the father of QDMA.
Would you agree?
He's the man. I remember Grant Woods at that time was an undergrad, was a grad student at Clemson.
Go Tigers.
Please. I'm just going to let that one go. Just going to let it go. Grant was actually a grad student at Clemson, and we used to have our meetings here at the Western Sizzlin Steakhouse, just up the road from the what is now Wade Hampton parking lot, but it used to be the Bijou Cinemas right there across from Kmart. That's how long QDMA has been around. So they have a long history, too, and they're trying to grow. They actually saw Grant, and we both commented we're a lot grayer now than we were. He couldn't believe I had one graduating high school. He said, my oldest is just a sophomore. But anyway, Grant's got a great place out in Missouri. He was a guest speaker there. Dr. Gary Ault was there. And some of your friends.
Yeah.
Westervelt property.
Yeah. Ryan Basinger with Westervelt Wildlife Services down in Alabama. Man, they do a fantastic job. And I really enjoyed some of his presentations.
It was a lot of work. I was there for 2 days for the National Deer Alliance Deer Summit. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. But most of it will affect most of what you're interested in is with the QDMA. And I was – here are just a few statistics for you. Kip Adams gave the opening address there, and he said deer hunting is an $86 billion business from only 6% of the population that actually deer hunt. You know, that's – but you got to realize that 6% hunt, and almost 80% of Americans support hunting. Survey in 2014, which is an amazing statistic. 16 million deer hunters over the last 5 years. 11 million of those hunt every year. And one thing that I kind of caught me by surprise, 97% of the whitetail population is only in 37% of the states. Most of those east of the Mississippi.
Never really thought about it, but yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Well, I never thought about it. That was just one of those things. Another very interesting fact, you know, hunters harvest about 6 million deer every year. The latest statistic we have is back in 2013. There was some research done, or they have done some research going back, and found out that Native American hunters have been taking about the same amount.
Number. Yeah. I thought that was pretty amazing when Kip said that Native Americans were taking the same number of deer in a given year that we take now with all of our improvements and equipment. And they had to, though. They absolutely had to. For us, I have to. I feel like I have to. But it was their lifestyle, the way they sustain themselves. So it's pretty interesting to think that we have played a vital role in balancing populations 2,000 years ago, just like we do today. So the argument can be made that if you pull us out of that harvest, you're really going to throw everything out of balance. We're a critical component to it.
That's right. And a lot of people think we're the fly in the ointment. And I've actually been guilty of that myself. I talked to Dr. Charles Ruth in DNR the other day and said, are we the fly in the ointment? He said, no, not really. He says, we're the managing factor in this whole thing. And we also spend all the money that supports all of this, too. Which is a fact that's not often brought out.
That's right. My wife will tell you that. I spend a lot of money. There's a lot of money that goes into doing this stuff.
But it's great. It's as a... Wow. You don't know where to start talking about the benefits of it. Mm-hmm. So we just won't go there right now.
Well, one of the main benefits is the dinner table.
Well, yeah. What is it? 1.6 billion meals a year served by deer hunters?
Yeah, and a lot of it goes through groups. I know that I participate with Hunters for the Hungry.
That's right.
Here in the upstate. And it's just a great program. It's a way for you to help manage your property, because you can look at your population on your property, and you can decide 3 or 4 does this season. I know I'm going to donate 1 or 2, and that's going to feed a lot of people. And so you feel good about it.
And even if you don't donate to Hunters for the Hungry, anytime you give a package of venison to a friend, you're spreading that out, and that's feeding more people that wouldn't on their own be able to go out there and hunt for themselves.
Right.
So they're getting the benefit of it, too. Ben, what are some of the things that you brought away from the QDMA convention that you thought were kind of interesting or helpful or that you wouldn't have ordinarily thought about?
It's nice getting everybody together, because even as a unified group of deer hunters, we still have different opinions on what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing and why we should and why we shouldn't. It's always good to get all those viewpoints in one room. And I missed NDA. I had to work.
No.
Yeah, I did. I had to work.
I don't believe
it. I missed NDA, but I hear that was a really good dialogue, good conversation going on between because we're trying to unify all deer hunters. Now, you're never going to get the same message from everyone, but we all need to be working together towards that common goal of protecting the white-tailed deer and putting our message forward that what we do is important. And why we do it's important. But I enjoyed Ryan Basinger, again, I'll mention his name, with Westervelt. He was talking about food plot configuration. And as a bow hunter, you always want to figure out how to get closer to those critters. And he was talking about, hub and spoke type designs.
Right.
He was, having bedding area right next to the food, which is critical, having plenty of cover, and edge. I think Kip Adams, he kept saying edge. Deer want that edge. We need to create it for them, whether it's buffers or whether it's whatever it might be. But Ryan was talking about bow tie configurations and the orientation of where the sun rises and sets.
Right.
But also keeping your deer stand not right on the edge of the property. And that was one thing we talked about a minute ago.
It's amazing. If you're out there looking for a hunt club, or you ride the roads and you can see the stands from the roads or whatever, they're prominent. I mean, they're not hidden. Most of those advertising photographs, that tree stand is, if not on the edge of it, it's out in the middle of it. And one of the interesting things he said was, why, when you plant those food plots to give those deer that winter forage and sustain them through until the greenery comes back, why would you want to push them out of there by hunting right on top of them?
No, absolutely right. Yep. It's you want to create the cover in the food. You want them to not have to leave your property. I think Kip, or it may have been Ryan, talking about you want your property to be the core of the core. So if you own 100 acres, that's fantastic. But if you and your neighbors are QDM in a cooperative and that's 1,000 acres, you want your 100 acres to be the core of the core.
That's right.
And accomplishing that is edge and cover and food and then water. And if you can accomplish that, you're going to harvest good deer year after year.
One thing that, switching over to Dr. Grant Woods and his seminar, He's, like he said, he's out there in Missouri. Mm-hmm. A lot of up and downs. He's in his property, 400-foot
yep.
little mountains. And if you look at Growing Deer TV, which is his internet-based TV show, you'll see what he's talking about with some of those ridges and his food plots on the ridgetop. One of his major things when setting up food plots and tree stands was access.
Yep.
And he was very specific. He said, I put this stand here because I know it can access that on a north wind, a south wind, yep. or a west wind. He said, east is blown. He said, but that is a very big component of where you put, place things in your property.
Mm-hmm. A lot of thought goes into that. I did wind maps on my property last year, and where all my deer stands were, I figured out the prevailing wind and how do you enter, how do you exit, which winds do you hunt, and it'll change during the season. If you've got persimmon groves or oaks that are dropping certain times of the year, the deer are going to bed in a certain place, and then that could change late season, and it could just be a travel corridor, getting a bedding area or a different food source. So it may stay consistent on your property, on mine it moves, which is frustrating, but that's just the way it goes.
Well, ours is in a big transition. We thinned our pine trees. We cut a lot of hardwoods. We clear cut some of our others. So we're in a real transition this year. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to know this year what happens. It's going to take us a couple of years to kind of get used to what's going to be the norm on our property anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else you got?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, there's one session that I believe Matt Ross conducted, or Kip, but they were aging deer on the hoof. And that was cool when they'd pop the deer up. You know, you'd have your little keypad,
right.
and you'd pick. And I was probably 70%. And it was pretty funny because a lot of them are marginal. You don't know until you pull the jaw or something. But looking at them, that was a really fun thing that QDMA decided to do to help people. Because when you're a bow hunter, you may have 10 seconds
right.
to determine, is that deer mature or not? And then a lot of guys might be thinking 3.5-year-old deer is mature, and that's what I'm looking for. And some guys want a 4.5 or older. God bless them. Not me.
I can't 3.5. That long.
No, 3.5. So if you're looking at a deer, it's pretty easy to say 1 or 2 and then pass. That 3 to 4, if you're making that decision, that's, and you're a bow hunter, that's tough. And I think that exercise where they would flash a picture, you had just a few minutes to make a decision, or just a few seconds rather, to make a decision. It was interesting to see the results. It was all over the board in some cases.
Oh, all over the board. And it does get harder. The older those deer get, but the changes are pretty evident. 1.5, 2.5, mm-hmm. 3.5. Once you get past 3.5, it's all looking at where that neck comes into the chest and all.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It does get in.
Stop looking at the antlers and look at the body.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
That's exactly right. One interesting fact that came that I think is very good for our sport is that the harvest ratios on the younger bucks has gone way down from what it was 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We're saying now 36% of the harvest is those mature bucks, and that's what we want.
3.5 or older. Yep.
3.5 older, which on one sense is good. On another sense, it's, you're going to have to be a better hunter because those deer are getting older. They're smarter. They're cleverer. They know. And that's the thing that always amazes me. Those deer are out. They're deer 365 days a year, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
We work in offices.
Mm-hmm.
We get out there and we try to play outdoorsman for, 15 days a year?
That's it. Yeah. I'll tell you real quick what else was pretty cool at the convention. I got to spend some time with Hank Forrester, the director of education for QDMA.
Yes.
And he's in charge of the Rack Pack program.
That's him.
And that's also, you know, hunter recruitment is where we're missing the boat. Access to land is another issue. But if you don't have the people, the land doesn't matter.
That's
and
right.
So Hank's doing a wonderful job of getting children 17 and younger into hunting, but also more than that, just engaged. And which was really cool to spend some time with him. 1,700 kids this year will participate through Rack Pack. He's doing a fantastic job.
He is. All right, there's the music. We'll be back on the other side of the break with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Ben says he's going to opt out of this segment.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
I'm just going to listen.
But, you know, this segment is a great one. I've enjoyed it. I hope he has. But it's a Defending the Cup with FLW Pro Anthony Gagliardi, who was the 2014 FLW champion. Anthony, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good this morning. How are you?
I'm good. No complaints at all. like I said, before we get into where you are and what you're doing right now, let's look back at Beaver Lake. You finished 31st out of 154. Is that pretty good on your chart, or did you wish you'd done better?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Obviously, I'd like to have done a little bit better. I had a really good first day there and thought I was primed to make the cut, that top 20 cut. And that second day, just it was tough on me, and I just couldn't find enough fish to carry me through that second day. I was primarily sight fishing.
Okay.
And I had to go through more of the fish that first day than I had anticipated. And so the second day, I knew I was going to have to, you know, go out and probably find some new ones as the day went on. And I did. I found a few fish that, you know, were nice fish in that 3 to 4 pound class, but I couldn't get them to bite. They weren't very catchable fish. And I ended up, you know, weighing the 8 pound limit, I think. So I fell from maybe 17th or 18th down to 31st. But, you know, all in all, it's still a good tournament. Any time that you can come away from Beaver Lake, you know, and make some money, that's pretty much the sentiment on tour. If you can get out of that place and make a little bit of money, then you can chalk that up as in the win column. But I have to say, I was pleased overall.
Well, good. Well, you're 26th on the points, so, you know, still solid. Even if you didn't have the automatic bid of the cup, you're still solidly in that top 50 cut, which ought to make you feel pretty good this year.
Yeah, it does. You know, I wanted to definitely make sure, you know, that coming off an emotional end to a season like last year, that, you know, I just wanted to kind of make sure and guard against any type of let up. And, you know, we're halfway through the season, and, you know, I feel like I'm doing pretty well. So at least from that standpoint, I've accomplished that. And, you know, I've maintained my focus, and hopefully I can carry that throughout the next three tournaments and keep moving up. You know, the goal now is to, obviously, you know, to make as much money as I can. I'm pre-qualified for the cup.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the standings don't matter that much, but, you know, I still, for personal reasons, you know, I'd like to finish in the top 10 in the points. That's my goal as far as the point standings are concerned right now. I'd like to make the top 10.
Okay. Well, we're pulling for you. All right. Now I guess you can tell us where you are and what you've been doing for the past couple of days and what you're going to be doing for the next few days.
Well, right as we speak now, I'm out in my boat. Trying to get through all my tackle and get my stuff geared up for the first day at Eufaula here in Alabama tomorrow. So we've been here, I practiced 3 days. Today's our off-limits day, so everybody's kind of, you know, relaxing a little bit, getting their boats, you know, all shined up. And,
right.
You know, re-spooling rods and reels, trying to figure out a game plan for the next couple of days. And that's where I am right now, just trying to put together, you know, some type of plan, obviously. You can't really ever put together a plan and be able to follow it verbatim, it seems like, in this sport. But that's what I'll try to do. I'll try to get some type of game plan formulated. And hopefully, you know, if things work out like you want, then that plan will work for you.
You know, I don't know, but Eufaula, Alabama is one of the – that four-lane entry in that town is one of the prettiest little places you'll ever be.
It is. That's a nice drive. You know, as you're coming down from Columbus, I think it's Highway 431, if I'm not mistaken, but – it is. That's a beautiful little stretch of highway, and it's actually fairly new. They got some new parts to it. And,
oh, do they?
Yeah, they do. And so it's really. I mean, it's very scenic, as you say. That's always a nice drive.
Do you know
they're similar to driving to Beaver Lake? That the last hour or so going into Beaver Lake is pretty much the same thing. You know, obviously more mountainous, but it's just a pretty entrance into the area.
Do you know there are two Lake Eufaulas in the United States?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I'm not sound good at them, but Oklahoma has a Lake Eufaula as well.
And I Googled Lake Eufaula, and the first story was Eufaula is like over flood stage and coming over the dam, and I'm like, holy smoke, I had no idea they had much rain in Alabama, but it was
right.
Oklahoma.
Yeah,
I thought we were going to have a real interesting conversation today.
Exactly. No, we're kind of the opposite. We're actually down a little bit here. Yeah, the lake's falling a couple feet over the last couple of weeks or so, we kind of got the opposite conditions we'll be faced with, you know, starting tomorrow, which is kind of, it makes it a little bit tough this time of year, because there normally would still be a decent population of fish up shallow, and there still will be some up shallow, but, you know, as that water's falling, especially in a lake that has shore grass like this, where
right.
The fish like to be, they just get really hard to catch, and they're very skittish, and, you know, they just kind of will pull out from the bank sometimes to spin out there where they're just really hard to target, so. There'll be a little bit of that going on, and as well, there'll probably be, you know, a decent offshore bite, which is probably what I'll probably try to target most of the day anyway.
Okay. All right. You just, there's one of those words. And you talk to me and you say offshore, I'm thinking 60 miles off the coast in the Gulf Stream fishing 600 or 700 feet of water. In the FLW or the pro fishing world, explain to us a little bit about the offshore fishing. What is that?
Well, basically, you know, when somebody says, you know, when somebody says they're fishing offshore, it pretty much means what, you know, it means what it says, that you're just fishing offshore. You're fishing something that's not, it's not bank oriented. You
know,
you have a visible shoreline around the lake, and then, you know, once you move out, you know, that first, sometimes an offshore spot can be close to the bank. And if you have a channel turn that sweeps in next to the bank, and, you know, the fish may be relating to that deep water in that channel swing, even though you're close to the bank, we'll probably still relate to that, or refer to that as offshore.
Okay.
But, you know, basically offshore just means anything that you can't visibly see with your own eyes, you know, whether be it a mile out in the middle of the lake on a river ledge, or, you know, a secondary point, you know, that you're just fishing out off that point in 10 to 15 foot of water. Yeah, pretty much the term offshore encompasses all of that.
Okay. Well, that explains a lot. And when you're fishing offshore, are you fishing a crankbait, or what are you fishing with when you're fishing offshore? Is there one or two, or is there just a myriad of what you can throw out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different baits, a lot of different techniques that you can use, and crankbaits have been a part of that for a number of years. Swim baits have kind of come into play. That's one of my favorite ways now to catch them, you know, when I'm fishing that style, fishing offshore, fishing ledges and things like that, is to use some type of big swim bait. You know, your traditional Carolina rigs and, you know, football head jigs and all that stuff still come into play as well. And I'm sure there'll be, you know, there's going to be a lot of that going on. There'll be guys catching here on swim baits. They're going to catch them on a deep diving crankbait, Carolina rig, Texas rig, football jigs. I mean, all that kind of stuff. You know, this time of year, you can pretty much find somewhere where they'll bite any one particular bait. So that's one good thing about fishing this time of year on a lake like this, where these fish do move out there, is you can, if you spend enough time out there, you're able to find the type of fish that you're trying to catch. You know, if your favorite technique is to drag a football jig, you can spend enough time out here and find some fish that'll bite doing that. Or if it's deep diving crankbaits, you can find that as well. So you're able to kind of fish to your strength in an event like this on a lake like this.
The key to all that's time, though, right?
A lot of times there's a window during the day when those fish will definitely be active and they're going to bite. And then there's times when you can trigger that. You know, you might be able to pull into a school that's inactive, and, you know, if you fish it, you know, 10 or 15, 20 minutes and finally get one to bite, a lot of times that'll fire a school up, and then the whole school will get active, and you'll start catching them every cast. And then by the same token, there's times when you can't get them to bite. You know, they're not going to fire, and it's just one of those situations where you'll have to come back periodically throughout the day and hope that you happen to pull in there when those fish get into an active feeding mode. And then it's like night and day. You know, you can go from not being able to get a bite to catching one on every cast.
Just never know with fish, do you?
Absolutely not, yeah.
Well, the other thing you see when you pull up Lake Eufaula is alligators. You see a lot of them where you fish?
Yeah, there's a good many. I mean, obviously, you're not going to see a lot of them out on the, you know, a ledge in the middle of the lake, but if you get in shallow, you know, there's some really, really big alligators in this place, some of the biggest ones that we see anywhere in the country that we go to, and, they're rather plentiful, well, like you follow.
Be careful, we don't want to read about Anthony and alligator.
Yeah, that's the last story I need to be a part of at this point.
Well, you and I talked a little bit earlier, level rods are coming along. Give us the latest on what's happening with the rods.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming along great. Yeah, I got a guy, as we speak, he's developing the website, and I've kind of seen some preliminary sketches and some mock-up websites that I'm really pleased with. But
okay.
The rods are, yeah, absolutely, the rods are doing good. I've been fishing with them now for a couple of tournaments. And I've actually sold quite a few of them already, even though I don't have a website up and running, but just a lot of the guys around home.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, some of the people here at the tournaments have started using them. So it's been exciting. It's been a long time getting to this point, and obviously I'm not where I will be and hope to be in the short future, but it's going really good. So I'm really, really pleased with the outcome of these rods so far.
What rods do you have out there right now? I know we were talking and you've got some more in development. What are the ones you've got out there right now?
I have starting with my smallest rod, I have a 6'8" medium, extra fast. Yeah, it was kind of intended to use for a jerk bait, you know, a topwater bait like a Pop R or something like that. And you could obviously use that for, you know, a smaller crankbait if you wanted. And from there, I move up to a 7 foot 2 inch medium heavy, which is basically going to be an all purpose rod that you could fish. I mean, you're going to be able to fish a jig. You're going to be able to fish a Carolina rig, Texas rig, spinnerbait. You know, pretty much anything you could find a use for that rod. And then a 7'2" heavy, which is going to be a fishing rod pretty much if you want to fish from really, really thick cover and you need a lot of power in your rod to pull those fish out of thick cover. The 7'2" heavy is going to be really good for that. A flip and stick as well, you know, pretty much the same thing, but a lot of people just like that extra length. And that'll be a 7.5 footer.
Okay.
And then I have a 7 foot cranking rod, you know, a fiberglass cranking rod. But yeah, that was kind of intrigued my interest the most, I think, out of all of them, because that's not a tight rod that I usually fish with, a glass rod. But as I played with it, and my intentions when I, you know, I picked out all the components for the blank, I think there's going to be a really good use for that in the chatterbait area. I think it's going to be an excellent chatterbait rod.
Okay.
So I designed it a little bit heavier. It's a medium heavy. So you're still going to be able to fish a crankbait and do all that traditional stuff you would on a glass rod, but it's got enough backbone that you could actually fish a chatterbait around some heavy cover, and it just gives it a unique action, I think.
Yeah.
And then I got two spinner rods, a 6'8" extra fast for like a wacky worm drop shot, and then a 7 foot shaky head. But both of those have turned out really, really well, so I'm very pleased with spinning those.
Well, very good. Well, we look forward to finally getting the website up where everybody can go to it and
buy
them.
Yeah, and if somebody's interested now, I have an email, levelfishingrods@gmail.com. They can obviously send me if they just want to ask a question about the rods or, you know, use for a particular rod, they're welcome to.
Okay.
Just shoot me an email, and you know, I'll send them back something as soon as I get to it. And if they want to buy one, I set up to ship them.
Okay.
And all that. Go to the website. Everything's ready to go.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, look, good fishing this weekend in Eufaula. Originally, I had plans to be there, but I got a daughter graduating high school that, of course, wasn't on my calendar, but was on everybody else's calendar.
Right.
And so I'm kind of have to be tied here, but good fishing to you, and look forward to talking to you after the tournament.
All right. Sounds good, Roger.
Take care, Anthony.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I don't know about you, but I enjoy those sessions with Anthony. He is, I say this after every time we talk to him, and I talk to him some off the air during the week before these segments air. He's just as one of the nicest guys you would ever want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have
seemed like a super guy.
Yeah, you would not know he's a professional fisherman, and you know, you just wouldn't know it. He's gotten into rod wrapping. He was actually wrapping his own guides and all that when I talked to him last week. And he says, I'll gladly pay somebody to do this for me.
Sure.
But he said it was interesting to play around with different components on the rod blanks and what he liked. And of course, it's all over my head because, you know, give me a fishing rod, I couldn't tell you if it's a broomstick or a limp noodle, really.
Couldn't tell you the first thing about it.
Yeah. I used to could. But that's.
I was going to tell him just to watch for that bobber to go under and then rip a lip. That's about as far as I can go.
And his little son would love that. He actually told me he broke a spinning rod. It wasn't one of his. It was one he had. And he broke it, and since he had this rod machine at his house or whatever, he cut it down and made like a 5 foot little spinning rod for his son. And said his son is wearing the crappy out with
that
thing around his house. So having fun with it. Mm-hmm. All right. Well. As we said before, South Carolina, we've got a lot. And you got your South Carolina turkeys too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well,
okay.
I didn't tag out. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, but you got a turkey here in the state.
Yeah, it was a rough go this year. In South Carolina?
Yeah.
It was a rough year.
How's that?
Well, they just wore on me. They just there's a lot of empty mornings.
Really?
And I've not had that before in terms of just gobbling turkeys.
Okay.
I don't know where they were. We had them before the season.
Yeah.
And had high hopes that they would be there and we'd get there and do what we normally do, and it was just quiet. So one of those years.
Okay.
And it's not the first and it won't be the last that you get humbled by those crazy Easterns, but it was fun. It's always fun to get out there and just chase them, watch the sun come up and hang out with buddies. And it was a good year in that regard. It was a bad year for putting them in the truck.
You know, one thing I learned this year about turkey hunting, It's always good to have calls with you when you get in the woods.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The only time I made it to the woods this year. Mm. And, you know, I felt that lump in my pocket, mm-hmm. little weight, and I said, oh, that's my calls. Because I usually get everything together mm-hmm. the night two before, and mm-hmm. I had. Got out there, decoy set up, mm-hmm. ensconced in a cedar tree. You know, I just knew. I reached in there, and I was like, well, that's a shotgun shell. There's another shotgun.
You just had to put out the vibe.
Yeah, no calls.
Turkey calls, yeah.
It's kind of hard to hunt when you don't have turkey calls.
Pretty difficult.
Yeah, especially when I can't. Now, I'm not even going to ask you to do that here in the studio.
What's that?
Go ahead.
Do what?
Call.
No way, man.
Okay.
I haven't warmed up this today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Gave you a chance. But anyway, okay. It is nice to sometimes just take off and road trip it. Mm-hmm. I enjoy those. As much as I enjoy all that you can do here in South Carolina, it's always nice to get away. And Ben got to go to Montana.
Yeah, boy.
And get his Miriams. And I wanted him to come in and tell you just a little bit about what it's like going off after one of those grand slam of turkey. So the floor is yours.
Well, it's hard to even describe it, really. It was a hunt of all hunts in a lot of ways.
For a turkey hunter.
For a turkey hunter.
Okay.
Well,
just a great hunt altogether, no matter what you were doing.
Yeah, because the countryside is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't know the true number, but I guarantee I saw, you know, this is in a 4-day span, 1,000 white-tailed deer, 500 muleys, 500 antelope, turkeys everywhere. We weren't even hunting. You know, we got to see the hilltops with the ponderosa pines and the cottonwood bottoms,
right?
And prairie, and it was awesome. Went to Mount Rushmore,
in
South Dakota. Yep. So that was neat. Yep. But it was just a hunt of all hunts, and I say that for a few reasons. One, I got to take my best buddy Cody Ledford with me, and we've grown up chasing game management turkeys and game management deer and really getting an education on those rascals.
Right.
So to have your best buddy with you is fantastic. I got to – the hunt was coordinated by Remington Country Outfitters. C.J. Brown and his dad, Carl Brown, have done this hunt for 20 years now. And it's sort of their friends and guys that they want to kind of hang with. And C.J. did one of those fantastic jobs where from top to bottom it was taken care of.
Right.
One of those type deals. So we were treated very well. We hunted with Powder River Outfitters.
Okay.
So Remington was the booking group, and then Powder River was the actual outfitter. And Travis, Indiana, were wonderful hosts. The accommodations, you know, it was just one of those places right there on the Powder River. So you're looking out through the cottonwoods and the other ways of prairie. The food was fantastic. The guides were – they knew – we had guides in the sense that they took us to the property. They said, hey, a turkey's here from time to time. Most of these guides are really more focused on white-tailed deer,
right,
or muleys or antelope. And actually, none of them turkey hunt. I think maybe Martin, one guy, may turkey hunt. So they couldn't call. They didn't want to call. They would say, here's your area. Here's where I think a turkey might be.
Have fun.
Yeah, have at it. So we walked a bunch.
You will out west.
And you run and gun is what you do out there. One of the guys that's hunted out there forever, he made the comment, if they're not gobbling, then they're not there. And if they're gobbling, just sit tight because they're going to come in.
Okay.
That is not how an Eastern acts. Sometimes he won't gobble and he is there.
Right.
And sometimes he's gobbling and he won't come in.
Right.
So it was just, you have to sort of change the way you hunt in a lot of ways. You still have to be patient. You still need to know when to call and when not to call.
Okay.
And in those cottonwood bottoms, it's flat. And so you feel like you can't move and there's not a lot of cover. And for Easterns, you can't move and you need a lot of cover. And, here you sort of plop down where you are, where you hear the bird. We had several birds break from 500 yards to in gun range in under 2 minutes. Good luck on
that's
Eastern.
That's a run.
That's a day. It takes a day to pull an Eastern 500 yards, it seems. And sometimes they still won't do it.
They still won't come in.
Yeah, but if they're gobbling, they're there. Excuse me, if they don't gobble, they're not there. If they're gobbling, they're coming in. Just be patient. And that's what I did learn that. It was neat. We had a group of, I believe it was about 11 guys. Yeah, 10 or 11 guys. We killed 17 turkeys. You're allowed to kill two birds each. That's what the Montana regs allow. You buy your licenses,
right,
two birds each. We got there late Thursday afternoon, and at our camp, CJ said, we've killed birds back here before, right outside of camp. He said, we got 45 minutes before the sun goes down. Do you guys want to go? We're going, yeah.
Yeah.
So we threw off the stuff we've been wearing in the airport all day. We threw our camo on, and we literally sprinted to the back edge of the property, right where the Powder River kind of comes into the property.
Okay.
I'm not kidding you. the very first yelp we made in Montana, a turkey gobbled. And he was 450, 500 yards away. We looked at CJ, and we're going, man, he's forever away. Should we move? And he said, no. Just yelp a little bit louder. We yelped a little bit louder, and that turkey, we could see him at 400, and 350, and 300, and 250, and 200. He was running his little red head as fast as he could through that bottom. He locked up at 75 yards. A hen had come about 6 yards in between us, straight to him. The cool thing is we roosted him, which you don't normally see. He gobbled all the way to the roost. I could see him in the tree, so we had our game plan for the next morning. We got in there really tight on him, about 150 yards. Not as close as I would have gotten if we were hunting eastern turkey. I would have gotten closer. But CJ said, hey, that's all you need to be.
Okay.
Didn't realize it, but I could actually see this bird the entire time he was on the roost that morning.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of slid over. As I looked, I could see him through the V of a tree.
Right.
And which was kind of funny because I kept telling CJ and Cody, I'm like, he's right past that cottonwood. They're like, you dummy. It's nothing but cottonwoods.
They're all cottonwoods.
I was like, yeah, you're right. But anyway, I could see him 150 yards and just a lot of soft calls on the tree.
Yeah.
I saw him fly down. And as he was in the air, we just hit him really hard. And he hit the ground. And it was pretty cool. CJ videoed it from one angle.
Yeah.
And Cody videoed it from the other angle. And we were successful. The bird gobbled at 5:06, which is super early. It was in the dark. And we had it all done by 5:27, I believe.
Wow.
It was neat. It was very neat. And rest of that afternoon was we worked birds, but they just didn't come in.
Okay.
Cody had – we had a really – actually, Cody tagged out the very next day. He took a bird at about 5:30, a bird that had consistently been coming into a food plot that just kept slipping us. So we kind of figured out where we needed to be, and he gobbled two times, and he actually snuck in around us. Cody had no clue he was there. I was about to take the shot, but I really didn't want to shoot two birds before Cody had a chance to shoot one because I had no clue how the rest of the week was going to go.
Right.
Cody's a good shot, swung over really quick and took that one. And then I'm really disappointed because the next – it was only probably 2 miles away. We went to – we called it Shiloh's, but again, it was cottonwood bottoms. We probably bumped 300 deer out of this area getting in it. I don't even know how you do it, but hundreds of deer running out.
Right.
And we had one bird gobble forever away and ended up being the biggest bird in camp, had seven hens come all the way to a roost tree, and I didn't have the camera with me because we weren't sure which way this bird was going to go.
Right.
It would have been probably one of the best videoed – turkey hunts that you'd ever see. So that was great. And then I took a bird the next morning. We went to another place, busted millions of deer out just everywhere. And this bird gobbled one – for the hardcore turkey hunters, you'll appreciate this.
Okay.
We're standing where we need to stand to listen. We're in an oxbow. The Powder River just kind of wraps around
us.
We can hunt across the river, but you're just going to get wet.
Right.
So, we're really hoping a bird gobbles on our side. And a bird gobbles one time.
Okay.
And we go set up on that bird, and he never gobbles again. So you know he's there, but he's not acting right. It's not acting like we want him to act.
Right.
And then two birds start gobbling across the river. Really, they're just letting us have it. But they're moving down the river away from us to a sandbar. We're about to make a move to get to that sandbar because we think we can make that happen. And the bird, this is an hour and a half later, gobbles one more time behind us. So I switch trees, jump around. Cody and CJ are behind me, soft calling. This takes us – he acted just like an Eastern. It took this bird – 35 or 40 minutes to come 75 yards, and he actually slipped through these little bottoms. There's a lot of ups and downs, and it looks like it's flat, but it's not. He got by me. He got to 75 yards the way in front of me. Had no clue. He gobbled one more time in a downfall. I was able to swing my gun over. I let him come in. He strutted all the way into 25 yards. I was tagged out. It was exciting. Some of the most unbelievable pictures were from right in that spot. The way the sun was and all, it was just perfect. Oh, and pheasants everywhere, by the way.
Oh, see?
Oh, it's just neat to hear and see those rascals.
That's the beauty of going off. You get so used to what you see right here, you go off somewhere different. It's like, mm-hmm. Wow,
it's
totally
a place,
different country.
I'd love to take my dad someday.
There you go.
Yeah, it's just one of those places that you'll just never forget it.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thanks for coming and telling us
about
it.
Oh, it's all fun. Yeah,
for you turkey hunters out there, if you need to know where to go, then you...
Yeah, well, if you would, check out Remington Country Outfitters.
Okay.
Ask for CJ Brown. Those guys are connected all across the country. It's first class.
Very good. Very good. Well, I tell you, time flies when you're having fun. And I've had fun.
Had a great time.
Had a good time at the convention. We know we spent, 2 hours at breakfast?
Yeah.
We should be going to seminars, but it's okay.
Don't tell them us, man.
That's why. Oh, I'm sorry. Uh-oh.
We got to hang out with Taylor.
Yes, Taylor, my daughter,
girl.
Was there.
She's
which
awesome.
Was really fun.
Yeah.
One thing for a calendar, next Saturday, the 23rd, you got the Palmetto State Chili Cook-Off down in Fountain Inn, South Carolina, May 23rd, 2015. Chili's close to my heart, so, you know, go do it. Chuck Norris, summer's here. Chuck beat the sun in a staring contest. Hey, get out there. You know, it's wide open this year. Whether you hunt, fish, hike, just make plans to get out there. Be careful. Be safe. Take the back roads when you can. Don't forget the camera. Talk to you next Saturday.